TNT. Sonia Poulton and today's news talk, TNT.
And welcome back to the Sonia Poulton Show on today's news talk, TNT. We are dynamite, and don't you forget it. In this hour, we look at new measures that will introduce some much needed common sense into the classroom and ask what can possibly be done to turn the tide and stop the sewage being pumped into Britain's rivers. It's an eternal question, isn't it? And a reminder of our question of the day in the wake of Policing Minister Chris Philp's comments that the police needed to implement more stop and search. We've been asking, is this the best way to combat knife crime? Please do let us know. Here are our numbers.
Thanks for listening to us. Now we want to listen to you. Our lines are open from the U.S. and Canada. Call 1-888-201-6425. From the U.K., call 033-0024-1026. And from Australia and New Zealand, call 1-800-670-310. Free speech is alive and well on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Oh, and the comments are coming in thick and fast on this one. Logan Ninefinger says, no, sus was always a terrible abuse of police power. I ended up with a criminal record for a tiny bit of hash from stop and search. Oh, dear, that's not great. And AP Williams said it would inevitably devolve into profiling. However, in happy and prosperous societies, crime and violence just seem to melt away. And Lee on X says, Lee Parker says, no, it's not the answer. There is no one answer. However, it is a necessary and important part of the solution when used correctly. This is part of the problem. Such a simple question trying to solve a complex problem. And I hear you, Lee, but this is a breakfast show. And sometimes we have to ask simple questions in order to be able to elicit some idea of what it is that you're thinking out there. But I think primarily the feeling is that we need to do something. Clearly we do. We know that there is an increase in knife crime in our capital city and around the UK, actually. Although the one thing that's seldom talked about is over the last 2 years, there's actually been a decrease in murder in our capital city because knife crime is seen completely separately to murder. You know, just to let you know that in terms of police figures. Right. This is a really interesting story that has been happening over the last 24 hours. Lucy Letby, I'm sure you've heard of her. She's the nurse who was convicted and imprisoned for killing babies at a hospital. She worked at Countess of Chester Hospital. Many people, including doctors, have a real problem with the conviction. She's currently appealing it. We can't talk much about the appeal because she is also facing a further charge. But here's my question. Why are people in the UK not allowed to read an article that was published by the New Yorker magazine and questions in some depth Lucy Letby's conviction? We are told we are banned from accessing it because it could undermine confidence in the justice system in the UK. For real? What is going on here? Are we such feeble people that we have to be infantilized in this way? No, I don't believe we are. And neither does Tory MP David Davis, who used parliamentary privilege to raise an urgent question about this issue and about why the New Yorker essay is not available for Brits to read. It challenges Lucy Letby's murder verdict. It's a 13,000 word piece, and it is available to read for people who aren't in the UK on the magazine's US website. And it's quite insane because it is actually visible for British users on the New Yorker app. So even that they can't even do sort of joined up thinking on, really. The fact is, I believe that there are very serious issues around the conviction of Lucy Letby, and we must be allowed to talk about them, and we must be allowed to discuss them. And for goodness sake, we must be allowed to read about them when an investigative journalist has gone to the trouble of writing a piece about it. And more power to your elbow, David Davis. Please, let's have more MPs talking like this. It's absolutely ridiculous. And on that note, let's find out what's going on with the UK news headlines from our Gemma Cooper.
Keeping the commitment 24/7.
I come to you for facts. I really appreciate what you and your team do.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And here she is, the very wonderful Gemma Cooper. Welcome back, Gemma.
Thank you, Sonia. It's interesting about the Lucy Letby trial, actually, because I just did a little bit of digging and I thought to myself at the time, it was a majority verdict, wasn't it? The judge said that they would take a majority verdict. And only last week here on TNT, I was discussing a story, I think it was on David Curtin's show, the show that's up after yours. And that's that how majority verdicts aren't safe in terms of miscarriages of justice. There have been many miscarriages of justice where innocent people have been put in prison, including the one in, I forget his name, David, or he served 17 years for a rape that he didn't commit because it was a majority verdict.
Malinson.
That's the one. But there was a report out last week saying majority verdicts that actually then they're not safe because you might have one or two dissenting voices that are like, I'm not really sure about this. I think they could be innocent. But if you've got the other 10 or 11 saying, no, we think guilty, then those dissenting voices go unheard. And a lot of calls to bring back unanimous verdicts for really the big crimes, you know, murder, rape. Well, it's very hard to get a conviction for rape. But in terms of murder, unanimous verdicts could be the only ones. Otherwise, we do see these miscarriages. I mean, having said that about rape there, he went to prison for a rape he didn't commit 17 years.
Andrew Malleson, let me correct myself. Yes, that's who it was. Yes, absolutely. And there are so many issues around miscarriage of justice. You're absolutely right there, Gemma. We really need to look at so much that is wrong in our world. But there are so many issues around the issue of miscarriage of justice. And there are a number of people that I think really need to be seriously looked at again, including Lucy Letby, including Jeremy Bamba. And the problem is, of course, is these people get so horribly demonized by the media that they almost don't even stand a chance of a fair trial. And I know the idea is that jurors aren't supposed to see what's going on in the media, but let's be real here. They do. And that is the reality. And the problem, of course, is once these people are so horribly demonized, like a Jeremy Bamba, the public hate them so much that that is another level of kind of obstruction that campaigners have to fight through in order to be even to attempt to get to the truth. And of course, there is also Clive Freeman, who we've covered extensively on TNT and certainly on this show. And it's highly likely that a crime didn't even occur. And he's been in prison for 37 years now and could have been released 15 years ago if he admitted to it. So the system is wrong, Gemma. And now you've got me started. I'm handing over the mic to you.
I think it's really important because the whole majority verdict was only introduced in the 1960s. Before that, you had 400 years of legal precedent where it had to be a unanimous verdict. But now they brought a majority verdict in because they wanted to kind of silence dissenting voices from the working class, from people from ethnic minority backgrounds who they felt were more likely to challenge authority and not go along with prevailing kind of ways of doing things. So if you were that dissenting voice, the working class voice or the black voice, the majority verdict would shut you up. You know, you might have a bit more street smarts. You might think, no, I don't think this person is guilty. But the other 10 or 9 would overrule you, or 10 or 11 would overrule you. So it was brought in a very sneaky way. It's classist and racist, actually, to shut people up and say, well, it doesn't matter what you think, the lone one or the lone two, the other 10 are going along with the establishment narrative. So it really does need looking at. And there are calls to completely overhaul the majority verdict rule. Maybe the Lucy Letby case, as we're not allowed to see stuff, will be part of this if it turns out that she didn't do it. If you know, let's watch this one with interest, because it's a really important story, Sonia. Not a breaking story, but an important story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is indeed. And tell us, what are the breaking stories?
Well, obviously, one of the big ones is the one that you've been covering anyway with the questions. The policing minister wants to see a substantial increase in stop and search in a bid to crack down on knife crime. And interestingly, there's another breaking story about knife crime this morning. The national lead for policing in the UK has this morning said that teenagers are buying knives illegally online from illegal dealers as crime moves into the digital age. The lead on knife crime says underage teenagers are buying weapons from illegal sources in record numbers. They're selling on social media. Media sites, TikTok, Snapchat, and other sites owned by Meta. And he wants a huge government clampdown on what teenagers can access online, and also more controls from the social media companies and people selling knives to, you know, how do you prove that you are over 18? And even then, I think the safeguarding checks need to come in. So that's a really interesting story. And the other story, which we touched on at the top of the last hour, the UK's main food bank distribution centre, the Trussell Trust, said the number of emergency food parcels titles it's now handing out has reached record levels, never before seen in the UK. More than 3 million parcels were handed out over last year. That's the highest ever and double that of 5 years ago. Children and old people on pensions, state pensions, are suffering the most, they say.
I mean, where do we go? Pick one, Gemma, and let's go for it.
I think the food bank story is very significant.
I hope you would say that.
Yeah, yes. It's very significant because these numbers are going up. They are going up in record numbers. The Trussell Trust says they're historically high levels of food bank need. And as a society, we cannot allow this to continue. The main culprits are the soaring energy prices and the price of food in the supermarkets now. This manufactured cost of living, which is really hitting pensioners very hard. A 27% increase on pensioners going to a food bank for the first time in the 12-month period up to March 2023. 1 million food parcels were given to kids, 2 million to adults, mostly an increase, as I say, in people on pensions that they cannot meet. They cannot don't make ends meet. You know, the soaring energy costs really is the main issue here because of the, you know, and we know the energy companies are making record profits. We've covered this on the show before. And so it is back to that choice, heating or eating. And their headlines I used to see when I was a child, and I'm sure you remember from the 70s and 80s, you know, where old people were being found dead in their homes in front of electric heaters and wrapped up in blankets in the winter. And I thought, oh, we'll sort this out as a society. That won't be allowed to continue. And lo and behold, not is it continuing. It looks like it's getting worse. The Trussell Trust is calling on the government to provide a supportive social security system for the most vulnerable. And the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, which last year in the UK issued a report about how many children are living in destitution, not just poverty, said it wants a minimum support guarantee payment. Now, that to me sounds a bit like universal basic income. So you have to ask yourself, this manufactured cost of living, the fact people can't afford to food, you know, buy food, is it paving the way for, well, we'll give you that, you know, we have to be careful what you wish for. A minimum support guarantee payment system does sound very much like universal basic income to me. The government's come out this morning in defense of what it says it's doing. It says that 1.1 million people are now not in abject poverty compared to 2010. And a £108 billion cost of living support package saved people from falling into the poverty trap in 2022 and 23. That doesn't quite add up with what the Trussell Trust are saying. So somebody's not being entirely honest here. And my guess is the government. If it's doing so much to help the poor, why is food bank use at record levels? It's a depressing story, but one I think if you read between the lines, you know, these organizations calling for better social security, minimum payments, you know, that does have UBI kind of in the back door, if you get what I mean.
I absolutely do. And I think that it is an absolute stain on our nation. What are we, the fifth or sixth richest nation in the entire world? It is an absolute stain, this explosion of food banks. It's all planned, Gemma. It's all planned. I literally watched it. I actually documented it for the Daily Mail from 2011 onwards. And oddly enough, the Daily Mail can at times be quite anti-establishment. And they allowed me to document literally the explosion of it and how it all fitted together with the coalition government, which was obviously David Cameron, Nick Clegg. That was their coalition government between the Lib Dems and the Tories. And they came together. And really, the fact is, the Trussell Trust was a business model. It always was. I know they like to set themselves up as, you know, all lovely and there for the people. But it was a business model. And actually, the MD of the Trussell Trust came out in 2012. And he said that his plan, his ambition was to see food banks over the entire nation, which sounds like a business model to me, frankly. And so it all worked together, obviously, at the same time. We had a situation where there was a thing called workfare, where people who were sick and unemployed were working for free for corporations like Tesco, organised by the government. All these things oftentimes that weren't even properly documented by our media, because our media obviously is absolutely in league with the government and we're working together. So this was all planned. And one of the most awful, saddest stories that I've ever covered, Gemma, it absolutely broke my heart, was talking about Eat or Heat, was a man and wife, a couple. And they were so incredibly impoverished. They were only living in one room by the end of it. And they had to walk a 12. I'm so sad to even recall this because I wrote this story. They had to walk a 12-mile round trip to their nearest food bank. And I think after one visit, they just had enough. They went into a room and they gassed themselves together and they were found holding hands. And that, I think, speaks absolute volumes about what has been taking place. This is a stain on our nation, the explosion of this, but it is all very sadly planned. And I think for exactly the reason you're talking about, because obviously they don't do everything at once, do they, Gemma? They do it in stages. It's all by stealth. Because if they told us in 2012, listen, we're looking here at a universal basic income, people would be in uproar about it. But after years of this bludgeoning left, right and center, it comes to a point where it's like, it becomes like a relief, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You make life untenable, you create the problem, and then you dangle a wonderful solution, EUBI, which comes with every condition known to man, what's left of man, mankind, humanity, to steer us in a new direction. You know, and this is, again, this is not conspiracy. UBI, Universal Basic Income, has been debated, written about for quite a few years now, as touted as a good idea. And who wouldn't argue with it on the face of that evidence, you know, where you have more than a quarter more pensioners can't afford to eat because they are just about affording to heat. And the big massive energy companies, the corporations, making, you know, record profits. British Gas, I think, 10 times more, from 75 million to 750 million profit, yeah, in the last couple of years. You know, it's all engineered. I absolutely agree with you on that. You can see it. But of course, the public are generally, you're so sympathetic. There was £1 billion pounds worth of food contributions from the public to food banks, to the Trussell Trust, compared to 330 million in 2022. So 1 billion was donated in 2023. People haven't woken up yet to the fact that if they contribute to this, they're doing the government's job. They're stopping charities. Great, in a way, you know, neighbor to neighbor, friend to friend. But in this particular instance, this business model, as you say, I do have a couple of friends actually that they don't see the world as we see it, Sonia, but they see through this one, and they won't contribute to food banks. They're like, no, this is what the government should be doing. A few people are seeing it, but still, you know, you create a problem like this, and then you dangle the UBI. A lot of people go, well, that's a brilliant idea. We need to help people. No, it's a trap. It's a trap. Yeah. But in the meantime, people are suffering. That's the horrible thing. You know, kids and pensioners, it's awful.
Yeah. And if people don't believe what we're saying, please search David Cameron's Big Society. He made a big speech. And the whole point was that people like us, we would pay twice over at least. And that is, we would pay by our taxes to take care of other people. And then we would also be funding via things like food banks, for et cetera. The whole idea of the Big Society was basically to make sure that we just paid double everything and left us with very little indeed, that we, as I say, we paid with our taxes and then we had to take care of each other as well, rather than the state, which we are paying the state to do. Gemma, you got me going this morning. Right, I'm going to let you go. This, of course, is our wonderful Gemma Cooper. We'll be right back.
Johnny Vedmore, TNT.
Now, Jeffrey Epstein was a man of a thousand faces. He is best known today as a prolific paedophile child trafficker, not the best thing to be known as. But the public has been presented with this very simplistic depiction of his complex operation for a reason. Epstein wasn't only grooming girls, he was also grooming potential future leaders in business, politics and intelligence, with targets such as Bill Clinton, Ehud Barak, RFK Jr. and Prince Andrew in his sights. It's clear that Jeffrey Epstein was playing the game of espionage and dynasty. Epstein was a significant piece on a three-dimensional chessboard. Regardless of his eventual comeuppance, he had become a grandmaster of all the various games in which he involved himself, and his actions were not limited to child trafficking.
Johnny Vedmore on today's News Talk, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
So many people who had no history of heart illnesses have got it now, or blood clotting after the COVID-19 vaccination. Punish those who hurt people with COVID madness, lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Now, as we've been hearing this morning, there is a hope that schools are set to ban teaching sex education to children before the age of 9. We've heard that Education Secretary Gillian Keegan will unveil proposals for a total ban on the subject for infant children, with lessons not permitted to start until at least year 5. And the Education Secretary is also set to rule that gender identity is a contested subject that should not be taught in schools. Joining me now to discuss these new directives is Chris McGovern from the Campaign for Real Education. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning to you.
Thank you for joining us. Tell me, what are your initial thoughts on hearing about these proposed measures?
Better late than never. I think we have a crisis in our classrooms. We have a situation, you know, these days where I think adults are foisting their neuroses onto the shoulders of children. And asking children to give up their childhood. So I think the fact that now almost we have a situation where we've got to protect children from what's being taught in schools, as drastic as it may seem, is actually a good move. And I'm not used to complimenting secretaries of state, but on this occasion, I think Gillian Keegan has done the right thing. You know, most people say it's common sense. There's a general election coming, of course, all win votes. So, yeah, it's protecting children from the loss of childhood. And, you know, I think therefore I would welcome it.
Well, I hear you. I was forced to say this morning, I don't often agree with Esther McVeigh, but she wants to ban, rainbow lanyards. But, you know, even a stop clock, as they say, is right twice a day, right, Chris? So we'll take that as a win. So how did this gender ideology manage to embed itself so much in the classroom?
Yeah, often, yeah, the path to hell is paved with good intentions. A lot of the teachers can say, well, actually, well-intentioned. They think it's probably going to be a helpful matter to expose children to these complicated adult issues at a young age. I think they're forgetting that, you know, children do actually need to grow up in a normal, healthy childhood. And we have something called fairy tales, which introduce children to what you might say is the real world. In fairy tales, we have nasty things like wolves eating grandmothers and things. We have good and we have evil. And therefore, in a sense, historically, for hundreds of years, with a Brothers Grimm whose name is still used today, we've had fairy tales to prepare children for the real world. We need to step back and not worry about expecting children to save humanity. Children, you know, they want to have a childhood. They don't mind transitioning, but they could be a dinosaur one day, a polar bear the next day, and a prince the next day. They can deal with all of that. What they don't want is adults giving them or exposing them to really quite graphic, almost sexual material on TV or on video screens, and making them worried about their own identity. You know, children, yes, they'll say they transition between all sorts of things, but telling children, are you a boy, are you a girl, are you something in between, or there are 72 genders, it's very confusing, bad for their mental health. So how did it ever happen? Because I think society is changing, and these things from a minority view outside are intruding into the classroom, and teachers often, for good reasons, they're getting it wrong. We now have to protect children from their teachers. And that's what Gillian Keegan's doing today.
And not before time, I completely agree. How do you think that the smartphone has transformed this issue? Because we know that there are issues of social contagion around certain demographics, certainly teen girls who are claiming to have been born in the wrong body. And that is literally because they're passing this information along. But what about your thoughts in terms of the contribution of smartphones to this?
Well, when I a head teacher, 15 years ago, I banned the use of smartphones in schools. I let children bring them to the front door. That was it. Because they have a really bad influence. We talk a lot today about climate change, but the title of a book by a very eminent brain scientist, Baroness Susan Greenfield, is called Mind Change. And the impact of these phones, this technology, is changing the brains of children. You can actually photograph the brain and see how it's being affected. So I'm of the view that actually, although, of course, the technology is wonderful in many respects, it has to be carefully controlled. And I personally would support those who call for a ban phones for under 16-year-olds. We ban alcohol, we ban drugs, and actually the phones are addictive drugs. The educational cocaine, I used to call them. So schools need to get a grip on this matter, and yes, the impact of social media is devastating. We also know from the United Nations that it actually damages performance in terms of academic results. So the impact of mobile phones is disastrous. And by the way, what's really interesting is that if you go to Silicon Valley in California, where most of the billionaire masters of the universe live, those who are producing the software and the computer technology, they are increasingly sending their own children to what are called Waldorf schools, which ban the technology. Right. Now, if the drug pushers ban the technology for their own children, it doesn't take much working out. They know it's harmful. So we've got to protect children. What Keegan's doing today over the sex education, that's good. We now need to go a further step and help parents, because it's impossibly difficult for parents to ban their own child, and whereas the child next door hasn't got a phone. So let's say, let's classify phones like alcohol or drugs. You can't have them until you get to a certain age at least. So I personally think it's a very bad influence. We've got to protect children.
I hear you loud and clear, and thank you for being so forthright in that, Chris. Everybody, this is Chris McGovern. He is from the Campaign for Real Education, and I think he, like I, are relieved to finally start seeing some common sense about to re-enter the classrooms. Thank you so much, Chris. Have an excellent day. We'll be right back after the news headlines.
Now, TNT Radio News.
Newsflash!
Now, without further ado,
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken continues to fan the flames of war, taunting Russian President Vladimir Putin during a speech in Ukraine. A prominent Australian politician accused his own government of covering up mass COVID vaccination deaths in the country. And 3 years after it was introduced, the vaccine mandate that was implemented for health workers in the Australian state of New South Wales will finally be scrapped this week.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
Well, not everybody agrees with Chris, but that's the way it is around here, right? Madrid said, no chance, it's my children's lifeline. And Shug said, all as planned, in my opinion. I hear you loud and absolutely clear. Now, the Welsh Government's sustainable farming scheme aimed at promoting eco measures by dedicating 20% of farmers' land to woodland and wildlife habitat has hit a roadblock. I know you're shocked. Following protests and backlash from the National Farmers Union, the scheme's implementation has been pushed back to 2026. Joining us to unpack the implications of this decision is Alex Black, head of news at the Farmers Guardian. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning.
Can you give us a bit more background to the scheme and the opposition that it's been met with?
Yeah, so the scheme, essentially, since Brexit, the Welsh government is designing, you know, its own subsidy scheme for the first time, well, the first time ever from the Welsh government. So the sustainable farming scheme is its offer that it's come up with. It's met with a lot of opposition, like you say, because of these targets for tree planting and habitat, which, you know, farmers say aren't really workable, and a lot of uncertainty as well over budgets and what it's actually going to pay out.
How have Welsh farmers responded to the news of this postponement?
Positively. I think farmers are relieved. They're hopeful that it means that Welsh government is actually listening. There was a big consultation on the scheme, which got thousands of responses. So obviously they're hopeful now that the Welsh government is going to be able to take the time to sit and read through those responses and take them on board. But it does leave them with even more uncertainty. Obviously, for another year, they don't know what the scheme's going to look like. And obviously, there's no guarantees that what will come back will be an improvement on it.
Right, exactly. Now, this is your journalistic domain, this area. What are your thoughts about this decision?
I do think it's positive. You know, the unions and others have been calling for a delay to it. You know, we had a few weeks ago, we spoke with the minister and, you know, he was insistent that they could get it over the line for 2025. So it's interesting to see that they've had that rethink there. I think farmers just want to know that they're being listened to with their frustrations. And I think 9 months to respond to thousands of responses and then actually get a policy change over the line is far too short a timescale.
I mean, I hear you, absolutely. Obviously, we've seen farming protests all around the world, including in Wales, because that whole decision, that requirement for farmers to dedicate 20% of their land to woodland and wildlife, it met with such backlash. What did you think about that?
I mean, obviously, I think, you know, from an outsider's perspective, maybe it does sound like a big positive. You know, everybody loves kind of trees, tree planting, right, etc. But, you know, for a farming business, you know, it, that kind of sweeping generalization of, you know, putting 10% into tree planting, etc. You know, it's not going to work for every business. It's, you know, quite heavy handed. And like I say, one of the big things is that they didn't actually know what they were going to be paid for it. So obviously there's a point at which that it's going to be sustainable for their businesses and a point at which that it's not.
Now, obviously, you have Wildlife Trusts Wales. What is that? You know, they cite, like, continually, as indeed do many of them, because they're all part of that kind of net zero green agenda. But they cite the need for sustainable farming methods. What do you think about their position?
Well, I don't think any farmers would really disagree that we need to have sustainable farming methods, you know, but there's lots of ways to do that. I think that's something that's been emphasised is, you know, tree planting isn't the only way to, you know, farm sustainably. And the other thing is about kind of sustainable businesses, and especially in Wales, that kind of social value of farming, you know, it's such a big part of the community and the Welsh language. You know, we need to preserve those farms, and you can only have sustainable farming if you have the farmers there to do it. And the other thing, of course, is obviously the scheme has to have take up from farmers. There's no point having the scheme there that, you know, the environmental groups think is perfect if the farmers then don't take it up and join the scheme.
Right, exactly. So the analysis from the Welsh government suggested potential job losses, income reductions due to that scheme, right? So are we expecting a further delay or even a scrapping of the scheme? Could it be that unpopular?
I can't imagine that they would scrap it, to be honest with you. I think it will come in some form. Like I say, at the moment, what we have is still the basic payment scheme, which is what we were under the EU in Wales. It's changed in England. So, you know, there does need to be that transition away from the common agricultural policy. So they need to have something there in place. So I imagine that in some form it will come in 2026. Or, you know, I can't say whether that will be delayed or not, but I'm sure it will come in.
Well, in your job, you have a bird's eye view in many respects of what has been taking place in terms of the farmers' protests. Have you been surprised about the responses around the world to the idea of these net zero targets?
No, I think there is a lot of anger. I think we're all dealing with very different things as well. You know, in Wales, it wasn't just about net zero. Obviously, it was about this specific scheme. But, you know, there's also frustrations with policy, with not having a budget, you know, with policy on bovine TB in particular has been unpopular in Wales. But I think there's just a lot of frustration and you know, all these schemes, there's a lot of change happening in farming. So it's not surprising to me that, you know, people are very frustrated, and that's obviously led to a lot of protesting.
We had Wilfred, the black farmer, on with us last week, and he was talking about how we've all forgotten the importance, not only of farming, but of real food. And would you agree with that to a certain degree? Because it all seems so mass-produced, and obviously part of the protests are because we are importing really quite poor quality product from abroad. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's actually come more into focus in the past couple of years. I think we'd certainly sort of forgotten about that recently. But obviously, I suppose through COVID, and then, you know, we've seen situations where there have been empty shelves in supermarkets, which I think sort of 10 years ago, you know, none of us could have ever imagined that there would be empty shelves and those things. So I think it has come much more into focus, certainly with politicians talking about food security. But yeah, I think there does still need to be more done to kind of show the value of farmers and why we need them here in this country.
Absolutely. Just give us a word moving forward. How can we get behind them? Because as many people say, no farmers, no food. What can we do to keep supporting them?
I think the biggest thing is just to buy British, buy Welsh, obviously, if you're in Wales, but make sure that you're checking what you're buying and you're supporting British produce by buying it.
Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. This is Alex Black. She is head of news at the Farmers Guardian and clearly knows rather a lot about farming, which is rather wonderful. Have a lovely Wednesday, Alex. Thank you for joining us. We'll be right back.
Right now, The forgotten poor are waiting for healing and care, for life-saving medical care, for a chance to live with dignity and hope. They are waiting for Mercy Ships and you. Mercy Ships is the largest floating civilian hospital in the world, with volunteer medical staff and crew who donate their time to save lives. And now, as our newest state-of-the-art hospital ship sets sail, Mercy Ships will double our ability to reach children and adults who need us now.
Without the work of Mercy Ships, these patients don't have another option.
Mercy Ships is answering the call to serve suffering people who have nowhere else to turn. Together, we are going to some of the world's most desperate places and bringing a wave of hope and healing to those who need it most. To learn more about this wave of hope, go to mercyships.org today.
Hi, I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you out, because only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, Assistant Smokey Bear, call me Papa Bear, because I'm grilling up dinner. Do you get it?
Yes, good job.
So, what should I do with all these coals?
Don't just toss them out. Put them in a metal container, because those embers can start a wildfire.
I understand. The stakes are high.
Ha, 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 ha.
See, Smokey thinks I'm funny.
You're listening to Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT.
Now, this week, the Information Commissioner's Office has ordered United Utilities to disclose sewage spill data, potentially uncovering illegal practices that endanger our waterways. This decision not only sheds light on United Utilities, but also sets a precedent for five other water companies. And only today, it has been revealed that untreated sewage was illegally pumped into Lake Windermere after a fault. Joining us to discuss whether we can turn the tide and clean up our rivers is Mike Rattenbury, CEO at Power and Water. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Morning, Sonia. I'm great, thank you.
Can you provide some context for us on the recent ruling regarding the disclosure of sewage spill data?
Yeah, sure. This is a hot topic at the moment. We know dry spills are happening. People are taking pictures and showing them all over social media of discharges into rivers, into seas. But also, it deals with another hot topic, which is transparency, I think. Right. You know, people want the companies that we pay a lot of money to, we all pay our water bills, and we all pay our sewage bills, and people expect transparency, I think. So the two hot topics really are the environmental impact of these dry spills and the transparency side.
What has been going so badly wrong? I receive Thames water, and I'm sure I don't need to tell you the multiple problems attached with Thames water, but why can't we trust our water companies?
It's largely down to the aging infrastructure that they're working with, essentially. And I think, look, it's widely reported that the utility industry in the UK is widely underinvested in the infrastructure. And therefore, you will get an awful lot of issues, especially with an increase in population where we're building more houses. It's putting more pressure on the sewage systems. So it's definitely an underinvestment issue. But there are certainly ways that can address these problems going forward.
And we need to address them, don't we? Because we have such a lack of faith in our nation about so much, whether it's our education, our police, and to have a lack of faith about our water source is really such a basic thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, the utility sector was privatized, as we all know. Again, coming back to this issue of transparency, there's a lot of foreign owners of these utility companies, and it certainly doesn't help the view of the public when utilities put up such a fight when asked for data.
Why aren't the government doing more?
That's a very good question. I mean, I guess it comes down to the fact that they're private companies. It all really comes down to the regulators, and the regulators really should be stepping in and taking the reins on this and telling the utilities that they've got to get better, they've got to do things better, And certainly, you know, bring them along on that regulatory ride.
Talk to me about dry spills, which I'm not particularly familiar with. Could you explain what they are and why they may be concerning to the rest of us?
Yeah, sure. So typically, you would have a sewage site would take a certain volume of wastewater in, and it would be designed and built to be able to deal with that much wastewater. Generally, at times of very high rain, which we've seen recently in the last couple of days, and certainly in Wales, and last year, you know, we saw an awful lot of rain over the summer. When the hydraulic capacity gets overwhelmed, they're allowed to discharge certain amounts into rivers or seas of untreated sewage. Now, that isn't massively a huge issue when you've got this big dilution factor. So times of high rain, you'll have an awful lot of water coming through, so it would dilute it, and the environment's able to cope with that. The reason why dry spills are so controversial is that these are happening at times where there isn't high rainfall, hence why it's called a dry spill, where you're more likely to be bathing in a river or bathing in the sea. So what we're talking about then is a discharge of extremely concentrated sewage, and that's where the harm comes.
Oh, goodness me, what a topic for breakfast, eh? But here's the thing, I mean, it's an important one because we cannot live without water. I don't know about you, but when our water has ever been turned off, it's almost like Armageddon has arrived in this house, because you don't realise how much you rely on just opening up that tap until you no longer can, right? And so that's what makes me angry, because one of the things that you're saying, and very clearly, is that part of the problem is an old infrastructure that needs to change. But these companies are getting record profits, aren't they? Why aren't they investing more?
Yes, they are. And I think that then comes back to the transparency point. When there's such record profits being recorded, it's widely put out there in the media, you know, the pay of some of the utility executives. You know, people want to know why these are happening, how often they're happening, and why. I mean, there is certainly no reason why that aging infrastructure shouldn't be updated and brought into the modern times. So it's a question that's difficult to answer. I mean, no one knows why.
Which is terrible, isn't it? Absolutely terrible. And let me ask you this, because I've always operated under the belief, and I could be wrong, so please correct me, but we don't actually pay for the water. We pay for the processing of it and the deliverance of water to our homes. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very complicated process, taking water from a reservoir and getting it to a drinkable quality. So, you know, there's certainly an awful lot of steps involved in that.
Yes.
And, you know, that we need to make sure it's safe to drink. I mean, there's been some reports recently, I think, of some illness in an area in England where they're testing the water to see if that's caused some sort of mass illness. So it's a very sort of complicated thing. It's also one of the only sectors where someone delivers you a product, i.e. the water, and then has to take it back, which is the sewerage, you know, the waste side of it, and process it. So it's a sort of full encompassing process. It, you know, there's certainly a lot of moving parts to it, and I would certainly have some sympathy in terms of how complicated it can be. However, it comes down to this lack of investment.
I wrongly said that, described you as the CEO of Power and Water, which you may well be, but it's actually Coo. Talk to us about Coo Power and Water. What is this?
The what, sorry?
You're from Coo at Power and Water, right? Talk to us about that. I'm not familiar with that organisation.
So Power and Water, we build electrochemical wastewater treatment systems. So traditionally, you would treat sewage, you would treat clean drinking water with liquid chemicals. And obviously, liquid chemicals, they're very harmful. They have to be stored in a certain way to make sure they don't leak into the environment. Their creation is very carbon intensive. So what we've done is we've basically built a system where we can move away from use of liquid chemicals that are very harmful, health and safety issues, And we electrogenerate the coagulant that's needed to clean the water within the waste stream. So it's directly created in the waste stream rather than added as a liquid chemical.
Oh, like electrolytes you're talking?
So liquid chemicals will act to bind to the dirty bits of the water effectively. So like the phosphate in wastewater. So what we do is we generate iron or aluminium, depending on what's being treated, and they'll clump it together so that we can drop it out so that you're left with clean water.
I think one of the things that really infuriates people is the idea that even though these are private companies, what's happening about they can surely still be prosecuted, right? Why aren't they?
Well, absolutely. So this would come down to the Environmental Agency in England, and there's a body then in Wales that deals with the Welsh side of things. I mean, from the Environmental Agency point of view in England, they've obviously piped up when this ruling's come out yesterday. I'm glad you asked about this, because the Environmental Agency has said in response to this, as a regulator, they aim to be transparent. They expect the water industry to do the same. This is why I would have maybe an element of sympathy with the water industry, because the Environment Agency, certainly last year, in June, there was an incident in Blackpool, which happened to involve United Utilities, where there was a broken pipe, and that was discharging raw sewage into the sea. And the Environmental Agency, they actually stopped testing at the time. And they said it was because it was an abnormal situation and they didn't want to affect the bathing status of the sea. Well, I think you could argue that at that point, testing and knowing how bad that spill is, at that point in time, that was when it was needed the most. So, you know,
right.
There's some mixed messages here.
Yes. So the Environmental Agency need to be held better to account, right?
Yeah, I think so. And going back to your question about can the government step in, I think although the Environment Agency works as a separate body, I certainly think tighter regulation is the key. If people have to do something, then they will do it. And I think the beginning will be to understand how often these dry spills are happening, why they're happening, and where. And then at least you can look at what the solution might be.
We've heard a lot of talk recently about trains being taken back into public ownership. Do you think that the same could happen with water?
I think it would be such a complicated process. We're probably right. Too far down the line. However, I think all options need to be on the table. I mean, we cannot accept dry spills continuing to happen, I don't think.
So as you can imagine, plenty of comments coming in about this conversation, because obviously water is literally our source of life, isn't it? Red said, yuck, drinking secondhand water. Can't we have piped spring water that we can drink instead? That's a good business suggestion, isn't it?
In the part of Wales that I come from, we have an awful lot of private water supplies. I had one in the last house that I lived in, and I've got to be honest, the water was fantastic. Now that does have its own issues in terms of storage, in terms of on demand, in terms of treatment on site. It would be fantastic if it was that easy, but that's a very good option.
Lots of people have been transferred to compulsory water metering ring. I actually came back from a meeting to discover two men digging up my path and installing a meter without my say-so. I was so disgusted, like so, so disgusted. What do you think about water meters?
Well, it's a precious resource. You know,
I do love the way there are certain questions. I just have to say this. And you tell us so much in your size. This must be a source of so much frustration for you on a day-to-day basis dealing with all this madness. But you're absolutely right. Please continue. Precious source.
Yeah, it's a precious resource. And, you know, we're all under an obligation, I think, to use water responsibly. I mean, they're good and they're bad, I guess. So I'm going to sit on the fence on that one.
Well, fair enough, because you've been so forthright and on other things. So you're absolutely entitled to do that. But I think many people are discovering that their water bills are increasing as a direct consequence of it. In fact, just a bloke, one of the commenters says against his wishes also, we were transferred to compulsory water metering this year, increased our water bill by 50%. How do you even begin to check things like this, though?
Well, I mean, that's the point. You can't. I mean, you'd have to delve in and audit the spending, you know, the billions of pounds that are being spent by utility companies. It's just not possible. One thing is certainly worth mentioning, that our solution at Power and Water would actually save the utilities up to about 40% on their capital spending. Which is a huge amount of number when you're talking about billions of pounds worth of spending. But it would also bring innovation to the water sector, and it would certainly clean water in a better way. So it would move things forward when we talk about the aging infrastructure. We're here, we're ready to help. We certainly do have some engagement, though, from some of the utilities.
So if today you were approached by a minister who was in a position to do something and they said, come up with a plan, tell us how we can better improve this, the issue of spilling, the issue of water quality, tell me, what would be your pitch?
We would be pitching our solution, naturally, as I would. But because of the environmental benefits, the health and safety benefits, but also the cost-saving benefits. So one of the things that we've been looking at quite heavily is there's a moratorium on new house building by some rivers, certainly in Hereford, because they're concerned that there'll be existing works won't be able to cope with the excess demand. Well, we've got a solution that we can drop literally on a skid that would add sort of 20, 30% capacity to a failing works. So from our perspective, it's all about getting those failing works under control, which we can do very quickly, and then looking at the long-term infrastructure plan, which we are doing, to be fair, with some utilities, for upgrading that aging infrastructure to make sure that we can reduce the number of these dry spills.
Thank you for joining us this morning. It's been really educational. I found out so much more about water that I didn't already know. One of the things that I did know about water, it was I basically, when my daughter was little, I refused to use just regular tap water as it was. If I needed it at water, I would always boil it, because I became absolutely aware of the issue of cryptosporidium. Something you know about?
Yes, absolutely. It's an issue. When you're moving, storing such large volumes of water, it is so, so important to make sure that the bacteria or the virus within it is being treated and contained. So, yeah, cryptosporidium is a massive issue.
Yeah, absolutely it is. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Mike. Greatly appreciate it. Everybody, Mike Rattenbury from Power and Water, giving us all an education about water, well, certainly me anyway. Have an excellent Wednesday, Mike. Take good care of yourself. Much appreciated. Thank you. Thank you so much. And that about brings us close to the end of our show this Wednesday hump day. I want to thank you all, but I think we've got just a few minutes where I can look at the question of the day, take some more comments on that. So our question of the day was, in the wake of Policing Minister Chris Philp's comments that the police need to implement more stop and search, we've been asking, is this the best way to tackle knife crime? And let me go to the comments. Oh my God, so many. Oh my gosh, so many. And, Where do I start on this? Let's find one very quickly. Nick says we need to massively clamp down on knife crime. No more gimmicks like offering £50 JD vouchers for exchange of £5 knives. Did they do that? Did they actually do that? That's a level of madness. Listen, I want to thank you all, everybody, for being here today with us. Of course, my fantastic team and you, our wonderful, wonderful viewers. Do not go anywhere. Up next, in the spot for David Cutton. David's not with us today, but in that spot is Basil Valentine. He's standing in for David. And Basil will be joined by Alex Mitchell. Alex has a phenomenal story to tell. Alex has been on TNT before, but I think that there is new news. And the thing is, Alex is one of the people who had the AZ jab and sadly had to have one of his legs amputated. So he is a real life living example of the problems with those jabs and exactly why AZ was pulled from the shelves globally. And there'll also be Jim Barrington and Dr. Gavin Ashenden. And as I say, stick around, do not go anywhere. This is today's News Talk, and I will be back with you tomorrow. Take excellent care of yourself.